I dropped the thread, backing away from the tapestry. Sweat coated my palms. I didn't feel solid. I felt as limp and soft as a pile of threads. I fixed my eyes on the floor. More than anything, I had wanted to prove that I was more than a sheltered princess of Bharata. I wanted to show that I could handle this enormous task and not fail. "Weakness is a luxury you can no longer afford," said Amar.
"Compassion isn't weakness."
"It is here."
"When you took me to the night bazaar, you said you wanted my perspective and my honesty," I said, facing him. "I've given both."
"You knew the decision the moment you saw the outcomes."
"I know it,"
challenged Amar.
"Now you have to follow through."
The accusation in his voice taunted me. Where the throne room had once filled me with possibility, now I felt small. Amar grasped my hands.
"I know you're not comfortable with this."
I clenched my jaw. No matter what I said, he would think less of me. And all too often, I found myself caring about what he thought.
"It feels wrong. What if..."
"Never let your doubts cripple you." He stepped back, his arms raised in a surrender that made me feel anything but victorious.
"I leave this to you. I trust your instincts, Maya. As should you. Trust yourself. Trust who you are."
The door closed with a soft thud, and I stood still, letting the silence twist around me. The tapestry hummed. I turned my back to it, letting it guide my hands as my fingers hovered over the thread. The words of my horoscope needled in the back of my conscience. "A marriage that only brings death and destruction." Destruction was letting Vikram become a ruthless warrior who would raise villages to the ground and hoard power in the name of peace. I wouldn't let that happen. I gathered my strength and held on to my breath as though it were an anchor linking me to a thousand places at once. And then, I pulled. Nothing. I opened my eyes. The thread wouldn't budge, like someone digging his heels into the ground. I focused on the thread and yanked again, trying to wrap around its root, its length, but it would not yield. My heart slammed. It wasn't the thread. It was me. I wasn't strong enough. The tapestry in the palace had judged and deemed me unworthy, weak. Amar had said to trust myself. I had, hadn't I? But other thoughts had crowded my mind. Thoughts of Bharata, thoughts of what I was doing, where I was, who I was. All my doubts and insecurities. I dropped the thread and it fluttered softly against the others. I spread my fingers across the tapestry as if I could will it to listen, to give me another chance, or, barring that, the strength just to move one of its pieces. In response, the tapestry quivered, a glistening ichor seeping through the threads, dampening them. Light wavered from the dangling thread, and a high-pitched hum settled over the tapestry. I stepped back, heart racing. What was happening? Had the fact that I couldn't even move a single thread broken the whole thing? Light burst through the threads, dazzling me with a thousand streams of color so vivid that I could feel it seeping warmly across my fingers. Shards of evening sky, the cool frost of lonely mornings, drenching nectar-sticky heat. I could feel the color as if it were a dimension of time and space, heavy and solid, full of flavor, of life. It snuck under my tongue like a bright candy, and voices, loud and soft, whispers and howls, of passion so grand that it tottered on the edge of mythic, and sorrow so plangent they trailed their own shadows. I couldn't take it. I stumbled backward. The light draped around me, murmuring, muttering. It pushed against my closed eyes, like it was trying to pry my sight open, to show me something. But I already guessed what it would show, and I hated it. No matter how badly I wanted to belong, how dearly I wanted to draw breath beneath split skies leaking magic, and pretend like I had some claim to it, it wasn't for me. I didn't belong here. In a blink, the pull of the tapestry was gone, like it had withheld all of its magic and transformed into an ordinary skein of silk. The threads fell flat. all their enigmatic songs sewn silent. I dropped my hands uselessly, watching dull light from the window spill onto the floor. The weight of the decision settled across my shoulders like a thorny mantle. My hands clenched, frustration gathering steam and fury inside me. What would I tell Amar? That no matter how much I tried, I couldn't do the one thing he asked? I felt so caged and foolish that I slammed my palms into the tapestry. A clap of thunder rattled the sky. I jerked my head up. Thunder? It was hardly overcast a moment ago. As if answering my thoughts, the bruise-colored storm clouds melted away. I stepped back, cold clattering over my skin. The change in the clouds felt deliberate, as if in response to me. That couldn't be right. Nature didn't hear thoughts and adjust itself accordingly, did it? Facing the open sky, I thought of rain, and a drizzle started to fall softly. I imagined a blazing hot sun, and rays fractured the sheets of lightning. I gasped, stumbling backward. What was happening? The weather was becoming more erratic by the second, fumbling from storm to sunshine, from clear to chaos. Outside, the sky swelled, looming and crackling like some disjointed beast, melding against the palace, spreading blackened veins across the marble in an attempt to reach me. My skin prickled. The air was clammy and heavy, suffused with magic, alive, possessive. I felt like all of the palace's watchfulness had ended, and now it was turning on me, eager to swallow me whole within its walls. My heartbeat quickened. I ran from the throne room, but the magic followed, unrelenting. The floor gathered around me, shifting beneath my feet into small hillocks, slick puddles. The balustrades of the palace creaked into life, bending and snapping into trees of ivory and alabaster. All around me, the doors swung open, doors that had never once budged when I had tried to open them. Doors that revealed human and animal skins hanging from glinting hooks in the wall. Doors that had nothing behind them but fire unending. I ran so fast, I almost careened straight into the double doors of the glass garden. Pushing them open, I ran through the crystalline plants until I got to the banyan tree. I tried to clear my head, but my thoughts were no clearer than wisps of smoke. "Maya!" called a voice in the distance. The voice was distorted. I flattened myself against the banyan tree. A figure approached me, its edges blurred. I screamed, tripping over a quartet of glass roses, shattering them. Spikes of glass dug into my heels, and a howl ripped from my throat. Hands reached for me, but I fought them off, desperate, clawing against the stranger. But the hold was firm. And soon, my vision faded to black. Voices broke through my foggy dreams. "She's not ready," came Gupta's voice from both near and far away. A crashing sound of anger and temper filled the vacuum of silence as I pulled myself out of the fog. I shifted my weight, wincing from a sudden jab of pain. I could still hear Amar and Gupta talking, their words harried and rushed. I lay still, trying to hear more.
"Yes, she is. You've seen what's happening outside."
Amar, his voice was so weary, he nearly croaked out his words.
"I am always traveling, always moving, and even then, even being in 1,000 places at once, it's not enough."
"She knows," said Gupta.
"I don't know how, but she's hunting. Like she's caught a scent."
Another jab in my side wrenched a gasp for me, and I inwardly cursed. If I didn't wake up now, they'd know I was eavesdropping. Carefully, I opened my eyes to a slit, and the gilded ceiling of the bedroom beamed back. I propped myself up, rubbing at my temples, and I looked around and caught sight of Amar. Gupta had disappeared. From the edges of the bed, Amar turned to me. Despite his exhaustion, a smile creased his face.
"Wonderful performance, though misdirected in the end. What do you remember?"
I strained to remember anything, but all I saw were flashes. Vikram's dormant red thread, a glint of lightning and the surge of something nameless and powerful snaking through my veins. The tapestry loomed in my mind, a taunt, and then, with the full force of fresh shame, I remembered my failure. The thread wouldn't move.
"What happened?" I asked, my voice barely above a whisper.
Amar sat up and began pacing the room.
"Something wonderful."
He grinned and I flinched. His smile was far too knowing to be mistaken as comforting.
"You're beginning to show a sense of power and ability that has always been yours," he said in his silky voice. "It's why I came to Bharata in the first place, to free you. This awakening is what makes you a true ruler of Akaran. It's what lets you control the tapestry."
Nausea roiled in my stomach. The choices I'd made, throwing the wedding garland around his neck, agreeing to flee Bharata, were they ever mine to begin with? In the grand tapestry of Akaran, everything and everyone had a thread, including me. My stomach turned. What control did I have? The tapestry had rejected me. Perhaps he knew that, and that's why he chose me. I would be malleable to his will. But I was done. Done being treated like a child. Done being left in the dark. Done being instructed. Fury rent through me.
"You know just as well as I do that Vikram's thread never budged," I said stonily.
Amar bowed his head. Good, I thought. At least he could fake some guilt.
"I know."
"Why couldn't I? Why did you make it sound like I could? All this talk about being a true ruler here, this awakening of power, or control. I had no control over that thread. I couldn't even pull it from one side to another."
"It takes time, but it's a start. It's a new beginning," he said. A chill ran up my spine. "For you and me." He braced his elbows against his knees, the sleeves revealing the bracelet of my hair around his wrist. He had tethered a part of me to him, but I had nothing of his. He kept all his secrets from me.
"Trust me," said Amar, "and tonight we shall celebrate. Where shall I take you, my queen? Your will is where I lay my head."
My mind twisted into a snarl.
"How can I trust you?"
Amar's grin slipped off his face and his eyes narrowed.
"Have I not proven myself? I rescued you from death."
"You don't know that," I retorted, my voice raising. "Perhaps I would have made a last-minute escape. Perhaps the kingdom would have changed its mind."
"But they didn't, did they?" said Amar coldly.
"I'm the one who took you to safety. I'm the one who made you a queen."
"Queen? I'm no better than a caged bird," I bit out. The words tasted like bile.
"What would that make me, an owner? You have free rein, as always, over this kingdom. Much more freedom than any caged bird. Think on that. All I ask for now is that you don't walk alone, question you, breathe without your permission," I offered, knowing what he would say.
"I have free rein, except when I don't."
I pushed aside the covers, ready to storm out, when the silk sheet in my hand changed. The entire night sky had become our bed. Stars glinted in and out, comets zinging across the part where I had clutched a corner of the sheet. I pushed my hands into the fabric, but they seemed to fall through and through, as if this really was the night sky. The floor had changed, too. Deep teal and translucent, the waters of 100 seas. Beneath the waves, something turned a sightless eye toward me. A makara with a tail gleaming long and emerald. The salt smell of the ocean burned my nose. I felt overwhelmed with awe, fright, envy. Is this what I was capable of? Could I trust the person who could do this? I blinked and the images were gone.
"A strange illusion," I murmured shakily.
"Not an illusion," said Amar. His voice was brittle. "Didn't I promise you the power of 1,000 kings?"
He crossed the marble floor that had once been an ocean. Water glistened on his feet, and a gray fish flopped helplessly in a corner. He stood in front of me, his eyes hectic and alive. Even through my fury,
I couldn't look away from him. "You and I are the ground and ceiling of our empire," he said, his voice harsh and desperate, pleading and ruthless at once. "You and I can carve lines into the universe and claim all that we want. We need only share between ourselves. Don't you see?" "All I see is your power," I said, "none of my own. All I see are my words and expectations thrown up against whatever it is that you choose to tell me." "Whatever I can tell you," finished Amar. "And as for your power, I was hoping you would ask that. It's time to practice." "Leave me alone," I hissed. "Your duties in Arkaran will pay no heed to the whims of its empress." I bared my teeth at Amar, and he returned it with a half-grin. "From now on, whatever concentration you use is yours alone. It is your power, not mine."
"How would I know?"
"You'll feel it in your bones, like blood singing to marrow." I slid off the bed, and when my feet hit the floor, something silvery trilled through my body, like light had seeped in and was rediscovering me. It was like being full for the first time. Like being weighed and made whole.
"Power needs balance," said Amar. "Our game today, as our reign, is simply a matter of reaction. What can we do when chaos is flung into our face?"
A sound sliced through the air. I looked up just in time to see an arrow heading straight for me.
"What will you do?" asked Amar. His voice was everywhere at once.
I felt a tug in my hands, a strange itch and restlessness. Without thinking, I threw up my hands, all my attention focused on the arrow. It stopped midair. I flicked my hand, and it whirled to charge at Amar. He snapped his fingers, and the arrow shivered, paled, and turned into a blossom of ice.
"I take it you're angry," said Amar. The brittleness from his voice wasn't gone. If anything, it seemed more pronounced. "Only 2 more days until the full moon. Then, if you want, you may certainly fling arrows into my back. Until then, try for more creativity. We cannot just spin problems back. We must do more."
More, I thought. I could do that. I don't know how much time passed while we danced, spinning power between us like it was just another game. He tossed the ball of ice my way, and I shattered it.
"What were you thinking when you broke that?" he asked.
Even though I saw him across the room, I could feel his voice at my ear, low and burning.
"You?"
He laughed and continued to conjure things out of the air and throw them to me. Amar's movements were graceful, spinning. All his power seemed concentrated, and sinewy as the muscle that corded his arms and shoulders. Mine felt strange, lumbering, but instinctual all the same. I'd never felt this way before, as if there was an unexplored dimension in my body full of silver light, ready to be devastating. The power in my veins terrified me, not just because I knew it was real, but because I wanted it. I reveled in it, even as I glared at Amar across the room. He must have known, because he grinned each time we sparred. He flung a chakra of flames in my direction, and I turned it into a great wave of water to rush at him. Without blinking, he flattened the whole wave to a plane of ice and slid forward, graceful and serpentine.
"You enjoy it, don't you?"
"You know the answer."
"I want to hear it from your lips."
"We don't always get what we want," I said. "Tell me, this ability of mine was not something the moon prevented you from revealing, was it?" This time he had the grace to look guilty.
"No, but such things need a foundation before they can be known. I thought it was best for you. It was a protective measure, too. Untested power is a dangerous thing."
Another flash of fury shot through me. "I thought it was best for you." The light in our room clung to him in silver wisps. Amar pushed his hands through the curls of his hair, and in that moment he looked so lost. In spite of myself, I wanted to ease that pain from his face, to make him smile. I was weak before him.
"This is why you couldn't move the thread," he said.
"You need to believe in it. Believe in you."
Amar twisted his fingers, and the silk of my sari changed from yellow to deepest blue, flecked with stars.
"My star-touched queen," he said softly, as if he was remembering something from long ago. "I would break the world to give you what you want."
I touched my sari and the stars faded. "I want you to leave," I said, not looking at him. When I looked up, he was gone. I stared at the closed door before sinking to my knees. I had been a fool to fall so quickly for Amar's gift, the most beautiful illusion of independence. It had felt so real that I thought it hummed in my bones. Now it was gone. Even our kisses felt like treachery. All that was left was the unending and infinite niggling of something that didn't quite fit together. His words, his promises, my powers. I wrapped my arms around my knees. If this power was truly something that was in me all along, why would my mind keep it a secret? A familiar pang struck me. The absence of something unnamed fluttered just beneath the surface of my skin. A secret hovering within reach. Outside my room, a slamming sound echoed, raising goosebumps along my skin. What door was that? I paused. The doors. I remembered them flinging open, all their locks and bindings forgotten. With a lurch, I remembered what lay behind them, swaying bodies, the fog of decay, fires to drown out worlds. They had opened to my power, responded to it like a song. Guilt tugged at me. In the shadows of the night bazaar, I had pledged Amar my trust, my patience. But this was not Amar's secret to keep from me. It was mine. The warning rhyme flashed through my head. Perhaps it was not some aimless trick of the palace. I needed to find the door. I just had to figure out how.
Chapter 16. The Memory Tree. A knock at the door pulled me from my thoughts. I opened it, expecting to see Gupta, but it was Amar. His expression looked carved in stone, and his lips were set in a grim line. But the moment we held each other's gaze, something in him relented. His hands tightened at his side.
"I would never want to cause you pain."
I flinched.
"I am not in pain."
"Lie."
"I am not some animal you wounded," I added.
"Truth."
"It is only a night longer," he said.
The warning voice from the halls echoed back to me.
"You are running out of moon time. Listen to my warning rhyme. What would happen tomorrow?"
Amar hesitated before reaching out to hold my hand. I stared at the circlet of my hair around his wrist. Bitterness rose in my throat. I glanced from my bracelet to the other one on his wrist, black leather and knotted, dull and malevolent.
"Do these past days mean nothing?" he asked, so gently that my weak self curled around his words.
But I would no longer be weak. I tapped into that power in my veins, and a shimmering wall of flame sprang up between us. Amar jumped back, shocked, and then amused.
"A little ruthlessness is to be admired, but it's cruel to play with a powerless heart."
"Crueler still to promise equality and hide a person's true self."
"I thought it was best for you," he repeated.
Strange how something that only affected me was decided by you. Amar's smile turned cold.
"My promises were true. You seek to punish an illusion without fully knowing. What were your kisses, then? Vengeance?"
The wall of flame shimmered away. Anger still flared inside me, but now it was mixed with something else. Something I couldn't push away, despite fury. Want. "They were nothing," I lied. "They meant nothing." I didn't look at him, and then a bloom of cold erupted beside me and Amar was at my side. His fingers traced a secret calligraphy along my arms.
"Nothing at all?"
My heart twisted. I reached forward, my hands tangling in his hair as I kissed him. It was a kiss meant to devour, to summon war, and when I broke it, my voice was harsh. "My kisses mean nothing." "Cruel queen," he murmured, tilting my head back. His lips skimmed down my neck. Amara's hands gripped my waist before tracing the outline of my hips. Heat flared through my body, but just as I pulled him closer, a sudden clash echoed in the hallway, and we sprang apart. Gupta's screams thundered through the walls, lingered in the air. In an instant, small lanterns sprung up on the blank walls. Amar took off at a run, following the path of light, and I chased after him. At the end of the row of lanterns, Gupta lay half-slumped on the floor. He was shaking violently. His clothes were singed. I looked around, but there was no fire, no scorch marks on the ground or the walls. The only thing that bore signs of damage was Gupta. For all I knew, he might have spontaneously combusted where he stood. I moved toward him, but Amara blocked me.
"He'll be fine," he said coolly.
I stared at him. Danger had unleashed itself from this very spot, and we were standing around like nothing was the matter.
"If there's danger, I should know," I protested.
"Your intentions are admirable, but let me handle this."
"You haven't answered my question," I said in a steely voice.
Gupta's gaze never wavered from Amar.
"There was an accident."
"How?"
I nearly yelled, pointing to the emptiness of the room, the vast, leering space of the palace.
"Maya," said Amar through clenched teeth, "return to the room. Immediately. It is not safe."
I stepped back, scolded. Here I was, a child playing queen. Anger flashed through me. I turned on my heel, marching down the halls as shame lit up my cheeks. I stood before my bedroom door, but I refused to enter. If the doors responded to power, then power is what I'd use. I concentrated, curling my power in my palms like a handful of dust, and blew, seeking all the time for one thing. The charred door wrapped in chains. The door with a voice. The door did not take long to find. I felt like it had been waiting for me, and it only made itself known when it sensed my power fluttering against it like the lightest of knocks. Despite the chains and charred frame, it looked oddly ordinary, just a slab of wood, as any other. At first, the chains wouldn't budge, so I gathered my will and imagined it melting the metal. Like the weather that had bent to my will, the chains wilted beneath my hands. Soon, they were nothing more than a pile at my feet. I pushed open the door. Inside, a gigantic tree stood in the middle of the empty room. Unlike the slim trees of my father's court, gnarled trunks and twisted roots swelled this tree to an impossible size. Nestled in its branches and obscuring its leaves were thousands of small candles enclosed in glass cylinders. From a distance, it looked like a tree with stars caught in its limbs. I rested my hand on the trunk but immediately yanked it away. The tree had a heartbeat. It should have been impossible. Then again, many things that should have been impossible were possible in Akaran. The pulsing light of the tree beckoned me, singing with familiarity. How would it feel to cup the smooth glass against my palm, bathe my face in the candle's light? But I couldn't. This was the first place in Akaran that felt holy. Even the silence was hallowed. A length of obsidian mirror shined against the wall. I walked toward it, expecting it to be like the other mirrors of Akaran, windows into different worlds. But this showed nothing but an expanse of black space. Turning back to the tree, I walked around it in circles, staring at the limbs that spun out dark and forbidding, sharp as arrows, but also familiar, like a beast tamed to know my hand. I reached for the trunk, shocked by its warmth. Slowly I started to scale the trunk, my hands gripping the smooth dark wood until I was balancing on a tree limb. Out of breath, I leaned against the tree. Below me, the floor gleamed with silver veins. Reaching for one of the candles, I took it slowly from its niche. It gave way easily. Only when I brought it to my eyes did I see that it wasn't even a flame. It was little more than a slice of bright mirror. And there was something inside, an image,
A face. Startled, I nearly dropped the candle, but the image had taken hold. It spread over me, slipping behind my eyes. In the candle, I saw a girl, whose face glowed with the kind of beauty and slow smile that can make a man believe in magic. She spun happily in a grove of trees, her hands pulling someone along, another girl, whose face was obscured by a curtain of black hair. I leaned closer, and I knew who she was even before the other girl turned around. It was me. I saw myself laughing, calling to the other girl,
"Nriti, slow down!"
My mind was grasping, carding through years of memory, trying to sieve through every moment to explain the impossible. I knew that would be her name, and it wasn't a guess. It was a knee-jerk reaction in my soul. I stared at myself spinning on a hill. My skin echoed the night sky, velvet black and spangled with diamonds that matched the stars above. Even if we didn't look the same, I knew it was me. There was something more in the image that I couldn't ignore. The pulse of friendship, of warmth, of memory. I placed the candle back, my heart thrumming, as I stared around me. Every single one of these memories was mine. Why would Amar have all of this locked inside a tree? I pulled my sari closer around me, as if it could ward off the chill under my skin. Then, I reached for another candle and saw the girl I had called Nriti, but this time, she was screaming. Her roar was a hideous, heartbroken bellow. She was in the orchard of the night bazaar, tears coursing down her face and clutching her heart. Her legs crossed beneath her as she rocked back and forth. The image filled me with a strange ache, guilt. Like it was my fault, Nriti was screaming. The image faded. My hands trembled as I put the candle back in its niche and fumbled for another candle. This time, Nriti was wandering through the night bazaar, a sunken look in her eyes. Mud and dust caked her feet. Her beautiful clothes were torn, and her gaze was searching. Gupta's words rippled through my thoughts. I remembered his exchange with Amar, the worried sound in his voice. "She knows. I don't know how, but she's hunting, like she's caught a scent." I couldn't shake the sense that she was looking for me. A low sound drifted through the room. Up ahead, the ivory door gleamed brightly, and Amar's voice called to me from outside. I froze. I couldn't let him catch me here. There was still so much I had to understand, and so much I needed to know. "Maya?" called Amar again. He was getting closer. I rushed through the door, murmuring a plea for silence to mute the jangling of my anklets as I tore down the hallways, nearly skidding into the bedroom. I opened the door just in time to see Amar striding toward me. His jacket flashed a fiery red, the light from lanterns throwing his figure into relief. My heart was beating so loudly. I was convinced he would be able to hear it through the silk of my sari. "I am glad you stayed here," he said, taking my hands in his. There was that same flitting in my stomach, but I couldn't forget the memories in the tree. I couldn't forget that it was Amar who had kept them from me, who had chained them behind iron and consigned them to silence. Amar who had lied. There was no danger behind the doors, only the danger of knowing myself. "I will come back later. I only wanted to see that you were safe."
"Where are you going?"
Amar's jaw tightened. "I cannot say." I was tired of this answer. I could feel something nameless and evil blooming in every shadow. It wasn't paranoia. I knew it with the certainty of daytime. Lightly, Amar traced my jaw, his gaze lingering at my lips. Then he turned on his heel and disappeared behind the halls. I blinked. For a moment, I thought I had seen the snaky tendrils of a noose unraveling from the second bracelet on his wrist. Where was he going? And if he thought I would stay behind like some petulant child, he was wrong. I waited a few moments and then slipped down the same hallways Amar had entered. As I crossed the halls, a second shadow nearly crossed mine. A woman's shadow. My heart clenched. Who was she? I'd never seen another soul in the palace aside from Amar and Gupta. Her clothes were tattered, and she moved with a strange, labored effort, like she was in pain. I crept out of the hall, following the woman down the darkened hallway. I followed her around another corner and this time saw an impossible sight. Hundreds of people were walking through Akarin's halls. I flattened myself against the wall, eyeing the crowds who wound through the halls like a great serpent. They were tall, short, fat, skinny, dark, light, young and old. And then I noticed stranger details. A woman with a black and blue neck, a man who looked distinctly gray, a child with something sharp protruding from her side, and another man covered in blood. I clapped my hand over my mouth, my throat dry as I sank to my knees. They were all dead. The dead walked in droves, crouching in the shadows. I searched their drained expressions. There was no light in their eyes as they queued outside a wall of scarlet and silver flames. In the distance, four massive hounds, two pairs of eyes on each side of their heads, kept appearing and disappearing. Their mouths were full of something wet and silvery. Each time they snorted and dropped open their jaws, a soul dropped onto the floor. Hellhounds. I shuddered. Their coats of fur were close-cropped, brindled like emerald and diamond. Gupta stood at the front of the line, a heavy bound book in his arms.
"Go quickly to the south wing and await judgment from the Dharmaraja."
The south wing. I paled, turning slowly to a door made of nothing but pale beams of smoke. I recognized the arch beside it, the entrance to the glass garden. I tried to grab something solid and only vaguely felt a stone pillar against my palm. My knees buckled. I thought of Amar's promise outside the night bazaar, a kingdom of impossible power, a kingdom that all nations feared.
No wonder I'd never heard of Akarin. There was no such thing. I had always been in Naraka, the realm of the dead, which made Amar the Dharmaraja, the Lord of Justice in the afterlife. A harsh laugh escaped me. Partnered with death. Death shackled all fates. It was fixed, and all I could do was modify the ambiguities left between. No wonder Amar looked disturbed when I asked whether those who entered the other world died. He knew, and he didn't tell me. Gupta knew too. I looked around, disoriented as the shadows of the dead striped the white marble of the floors. I was about to leave when a familiar woman caught my eye. Vikram's mother. Her brow still gleamed with sweat, and in her hand she carried a bundle of wilting flowers. Her neck was bent too sharply, and bits of mountain gravel clung to her hair. She must have fallen. I retched onto the marble, my body shaking. Amar must have pulled the thread. What outcome was there for the boy? I was disgusted with myself. I wanted to fling myself at the woman's feet and beg her for forgiveness. Someone marched beside her, a figure silhouetted in metal, a limp crest of scarlet on its helmet. I remembered the stomping gait, the familiar vermilion sash now tattered and trailing blood. Memory clamped its jaws into my chest. He was a soldier of Bharata, but far, far worse than that. He was a harem guard. I remembered taunting him on the day my father told me of his plans, the young guard whom I had never bothered apologizing to. He looked aged, or perhaps it was the cold lights of Naraka slowly teasing out his youth. My heart slammed against my ribs as I watched the line of the dead. Who had he died protecting? And where was he going? Who else would I recognize in these halls? I wandered far into the line of the dead, pushing past them, refusing to shudder when my skin came away clammy at the contact. By the time I was sure there was no one else from Bharata, I couldn't find my way back to the south wing. The halls skipped around me. I was losing my way through the palace, but there was nothing I could do. The palace thrummed with its own magic, its own plans. Each step was a small battle against the draining energy of the dead. My skin shifted taut and stretched, as though I were turning skeletal with every movement. weighed down by the pull of magic and spent lives. I found myself at the threshold of the throne room. The doors were flung open, and as I stumbled past the entrance, I saw Amar bent over the tapestry. A crown of black buck horns gleamed on his head, cruel and slick. In the dark, they looked blood-tinged. His hands roamed over the threads, fingers flicking, yanking, snarled in strands that he pulled out in swift, merciless strokes, like he was tearing throats instead of threads. The threads, whole entire lives, fell noiselessly to the ground. It was a slaughter. I moved faster, heart racing. I couldn't be caught. Years could have passed by the time I found myself outside the doors of our bedroom. Our bedroom. The weight of it sent a stab of pain inside me. I had slept beside him. I had kissed him. I had even begun to feel something for him. I sank to my knees. I had never escaped my horoscope. I had only been blind to its meaning until now. A wave of revulsion rushed over me as I glanced at the bed we had shared. He had concealed the consequences of my judgments and made me an accomplice to death. He had asked me for patience, for trust, but he had betrayed both. Shadow and light danced across the floor through a sliver in the doorframe. What did he want from me? What would happen when the moon had run its course? Outside my window, an ochre glow crept up a nearly dying moon. I shuddered. The warning rhyme flickered in my heart, dredging up old nightmares. I know the monster in your bed. So did I. Death. Chapter 17. A Fine Legacy. As dawn crept slowly along the floor, my eyes flew open. The memory of my nightmares clamored for attention. Dreams of trees incinerating, of silent chasms deep in palaces, of threads being ripped savagely from their place. Beside me, the weight of the bed shifted. I squeezed my eyes shut, only to feel the brush of Amar's lips against my cheek, the rough stroke of his fingers at my forehead. A humming trilled in my body, but I clenched my fists, waiting for him to leave. Ache and unrest flooded my bones as I pinched myself to alertness. The room was silent. Amar had left. Pinned to the cushion beside me was a note that said I should rest until the evening. I crumpled the letter. I was done doing what Amar wanted. Ignoring the peacock blue sari on the bed, I smoothed down my silk nightclothes, fixed my hair in a braid, and crept outside. A Bharata soldier had walked these halls, and he had disappeared into them, too. Even now, I could picture the dead. I could see Amar ripping out the threads in a bloodless slaughter. The images scalded me. Every time I blinked, all I saw was the deceit that I had welcomed so openly, mistaking it for magic, for power, for something deeper. I willed the shadows to swirl around my feet, mute the jangling of my anklets, and conceal me in case the walls were watching. Though the dead had long since passed into the south wing, their echoes lit up the walls, as if the wisps of their lives had stamped burning footprints into the floor. Slowly, I wound my way through the palace until I stood at the entrance to the glass garden. Behind me, the windows leaked blurry sunlight onto the ground. There was no sign of the smoke and glass door from yesterday. The stonework had swallowed it whole, but even so, I could feel it like a cold shadow. It was hidden somewhere in front of me, wedged between some slice of air. I pressed my hands against the wall, searching inside myself for that spiral of power, that weird sense of calm, of summoning. And the door of the south wing shimmered. Vast and transient, that is death. I knew because I stood on the other side, peering through a tear in the frame, and all I saw was light. All I heard was my heartbeat's echo fluttering softly, sleepily, against my ribs. All I tasted was smoke on my tongue. A dry wind carried pale ashes across my feet. and the particles were so fine, it might have been like stepping over pulverized sugarcane. I could have turned around, but I didn't. Guilt stilled me. Who had I left behind when I fled Bartha? What had I done to them? Life and death surged from behind the smoky portal, calling me from beyond the door. Breathing deeply, I pushed open the door. Heat seeped through my skin, and I shivered. Cold sludge moved through my veins instead of blood. I turned around the room, my ears straining to hear the whisper of a voice, but only silence met me. There were no exits in the south wing, and the only entrance had already closed. The moment my foot touched the gray floor, lanterns sprung up along the dark halls. Their light was as silvery as moonshine, but cast no shadows. They were only beacons in a haze, like thousands of unblinking eyes. My breath came in ragged heaves, and the straight walk forward felt like an uphill battle. My muscles ached, and my head was dizzy, but I pushed through. Eventually, the floor ended, melting into a steep cliff with soft, sloping sides of ash. The smell made me nauseated. I could taste funerary ash on my tongue, and quickly clasped the end of the sari to my nose. Once more, lanterns lit my way along the edge of the cliff. All along the walls, sheaves of parchment covered in Gupta's neat handwriting fluttered in the windless air. I leaned closer and saw that they were the records of the dead. They stretched in infinite directions. The sides of the cliff revealed jagged steps leading to the edge of a strange body of water. Sounds bubbled from below, human ones. Goosebumps erupted along my arms. With one hand touching the craggy slopes, I descended into the depths of Nautica. At the base of the cliffs, a silver pool lapped at the stone. Something about the pool kept teasing my mind, as if there was some reason why I should know about it. From where I stood, the pale, moon-bright water looked like a mirror. I leaned over the water's edge, and what twisted in its reflection sent me reeling back. Spectral bodies writhed beneath, turned over and over by invisible mechanics. In its waters, luminous souls were being sheathed with new skins and new identities. Something in the water fitted a silvery lion pelt over transparent shapes, affixed tusks to a humanoid snout, braceleted a dancer's gungru bells around the ghost of an ankle. This was the reincarnation pool, the place for remaking souls. I stumbled backward, flailing a hand behind me until it hit rock. Something seared my skin, and I turned, eyes widening as the wall of rock shimmered and revealed a thousand rooms sprawled behind it, some filled with ice, others with flame. At first, I thought the rooms were empty, but then I saw the souls toiling in the flickering light. Some were digging holes, sweat glittering thickly on their necks. Others hung suspended by chains, their groans echoing in their cells. I knew why they were there. Before passing to the next life, the soul must atone for sins of the past life. I walked past the sea of cells, relief flooding me each time I didn't recognize someone. "Mayavati?" called a voice. I halted in my tracks. Turning to the sound, a cry escaped my lips. "The Raja!" My father walked toward me, pressing his palms against the wall of glass separating us. Instead of his familiar kurta, he wore armor, his worn battle helmet tucked beneath his arm. Chainmail peeled off his body, revealing a dark gash near his ribcage. "No," I whispered. I stretched out my hand but retracted it suddenly and wrapped my arms around myself. The last time I saw him, he wanted me dead. Anger should have welled in my heart, but all I could see was a man wearing the wounds of his death day. A man who had once left me gifts of poetry and knew my name when he could barely recall his number of offspring. A man with regret printed on his features. I tried to control my breathing, but it came in unsteady halts. His chainmail glinted as he moved toward me, throwing his wounds in stark relief. In Bharata, modesty would demand that I cover my head, avert my eyes, and wait for him to speak. But death left no room for formality.
"Were you in pain?"
I asked, my voice barely above a whisper. The Raja shrugged, and I winced as the gash on his collarbones widened.
"It was fast," he said, looking away from me.
I knew he was lying, but didn't press him. For the first time, I noticed that the lines of worry from his face were gone. He was calm, even in this glass dungeon. And he smiled at me, a smile filled with unguarded relief, even joy, to see me once more. He cleared his throat.
"My accommodations are not nearly as grand as the palace, but it is better than most. A sin of selfishness demands a penance of introspection, not labor."
I nodded numbly.
"You look well," he said, tilting his head to one side. "I am glad you escaped before they descended on us."
His eyes shone with tears, and I wished there was no glass to separate us. I wanted to press my forehead against the lattice of his armor. Tell him I forgave him. But he guessed all that I wished to say, because he shook his head with a sad smile.
"We lost the war," I ventured.
The Raja paused.
"Bharata won the war, but I am the one who lost. I led people to death. I allowed my halls to be swallowed by fire. But Bharata survived."
He leaned against a wall of mirror, rubbing his temples. His hair had grayed considerably since the wedding. How was that possible? Had time tricked me as well? And then another wrenching thought went through me. The lack of mirrors and akaran that showed the viewer. There was a puddle beside my feet, no larger than a palm full of water. But I recognized myself. Perhaps a little lovelier, a little more regal, but still 17.
"How long did the war last?"
I asked, my voice hoarse. The Raja blinked at me.
"It was 10 years ago," he said slowly. "Surely you've seen your countrymen in these halls?"
I suddenly felt dizzy. 10 years had passed since I was in Bharata? When Amar asked me to wait until the full moon, he had spoken of a matter of days, not years. Fresh fury poured through my veins. I hated him. If I'd seen Bharata's citizens, could I have saved them? I looked up to see the Raja considering me from the wall of his cell.
"I never saw them," I said quietly.
He was silent for a moment.
"At first I thought you were your mother, come to free me from my hell, like an angel. You take after her, though you are as young as I remember."
I stared at my ash-covered feet, and the hair that fell in a must braid by my side. I thought of Bharata's dead walking past my bedroom while I slept. I thought of Vikram weeping for his dead mother while I kissed the Dharmaraja in a winter room. I was no angel.
"Who rules in your stead?"
"The Yuvaraja, Skanda," said the Raja, thoughtfully tugging on his beard. Death had not relieved him of all his habits. I almost smiled to see the familiar gesture.
"I hope he remembers all I have said. Sometimes I expect to see him across my cell, and I do not know if he will be young as I remember him, or old because time has passed and I am here."
He looked at the ground.
"Do not pity me, daughter. Everyone comes here. Some merely stay longer than others."
We stared at each other through the glass. I could feel his eyes searching me, trying to match up the memory of when he had last seen me to the person who stood before him now.
"Partnered with death itself," he said,
repeating a part of my horoscope.
A harsh laugh escaped him. "I understand now."
The Raja moved away from his mirror wall, his eyes twinkling as he bowed low. The gesture was wrong. My cheeks flared with heat.
"No," I said. "Please don't do that."
Pressing my palms against the glass, I willed it away, and slowly it became thinner and thinner until it disappeared. The Raja, still bent in a bow, looked up in surprise as I walked into his cell. I lifted him up by the shoulders, not letting myself flinch when my fingers brushed against the blood on his armor.
"You do not need to bow to me, father."
The Raja smiled.
"Your forgiveness makes my hell easier to bear."
This conversation, this air of ease unshackled from courtly posturing, struck me. It was so natural. We might have even been close in another lifetime.
"I do not know how you became a princess of Bharata," he said. "Who knows how our last lives slip into the ones we live in now? I will never know those memories, and perhaps that is for the best."
A lump rose in my throat. I will never know those memories. The tree behind the chained door. It had so many memories, all of which, I was convinced, belonged to me. Nriti's image flashed in my head, bright as a flame. I didn't know her from this life, but I must have known her from before. My father must have seen a look cross over my face, because he stepped away from me.
"You do not belong here, daughter. Go. Be who you will be. Do not waste your life mourning the dead."
I nodded tightly, my throat thick with so many things left unsaid.
"I will not forget you, father."
He smiled.
"That pleases me. A memory is a fine legacy to leave behind."
I stood before the tree filled with memories. My feet still bore the signs of the south wing. Gritty bits of ash clung to my ankles. Each time I blinked, I saw the sea of cells stretched out in front of me like waves. My father's words echoed in my thoughts. In death, he found what he could not in life. Peace. Even then my hands curled into fists. A single door, not 1,000 miles, had separated me from my father. And Amar had known the whole time. He had gathered the souls of my countrymen, shepherded them to their next lives without once telling me what was happening outside my very door. On the far side of the wall, the obsidian mirror glittered. It was still a blank expanse of black, but there was something else there. A warmth, like it was awake. Turning from it, I circled the tree trunk before climbing into the hulking branches, ignoring the snags of boughs that pulled at my hair as I reached higher and higher. When I reached the middle, I caught my breath and grabbed one of the candles. It trembled in my cupped palms, and light spilled over my fingers, stealing my vision. I saw Amar bent over the reincarnation pool, his knuckles gripping the water's pebbled edges. There was something in his hand, an amethyst crown. I couldn't tell what he saw in the pool, but whatever it was, it twisted his face in anguish. In fury. In another candle flame, Amar was cradling a tree limb that held a single flame green as new jealousy. I couldn't understand it. What was he doing? I reached for a final candle, and something in my chest splintered. When I opened my eyes, I was inside Bharata. To the right were the familiar honeysuckle vines and the copse of trees. On the left was a statue covered in jasmine, where I had once hid Mother Dina's slippers. My smile faltered. A sound in the vision caught my attention, and I turned to see three girls standing in front of a decorated tent. I frowned. I knew that tent. It was the snake singer's tent from my 10th age day. The two girls had to be Jaya and Malika. Therefore, the girl beside them had to be me. The vision changed. Now I was inside the snake singer's tent, standing before a basket of cobras. Amar stroked the inky creatures, patting their heads. His hands twitched at the defiant, tremulous sound of a voice in the distance. My stomach flipped at the memory. This was the moment I lost the argument against my half-sisters. Any minute now, my younger self would be thrust inside the tent. The vision spun, and from the shadows of the tent, I saw myself lying face down in the dirt. My half-sisters had upturned the baskets of snakes. I watched myself anticipate the cobra's bite, my hands clenched and my eyes squeezed shut, as the same snake that Amar had stroked slithered